From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Mike Waters, and this is Options. This edition of Options is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. The program is a panel discussion about the future of China. We call it China, What Next? On our panel is Doak Barnett. He's Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of two recent Brookings books, China Policy, Old Problems and New Challenges, and China and the Major Powers in East Asia. Also on the panel, Professor Kenneth Lieberthal. He's with the Department of Political Science at Swarthmore College. And Dr. James Reardon Anderson. He's Assistant Professor of Asian Studies, Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Our host is Stephen Rosenfeld of the Washington Post. Now, there's one more thing you should know before hearing the program. After the discussion was recorded, we edited the tape for reasons of time. During the editing, the tape rimmed. That is, a few seconds of tape got caught between the top of a steel take-up reel and the tape already on the reel. That section of tape was stretched and is not airable. So when we get to that point in the program, I'll fill in the missing part. Now, our discussion begins with Stephen Rosenfeld's first question. It's for Doak Barnett.
Doak, you've been most recently in China among us. What's up?
Well, I think this is a very interesting period in China, in some respects a confusing period, starting with the death of Mao a little over a year ago. It seemed to me that China has entered a really new period. I would go so far as to say it's really a new period in its entire history since the communist takeover, since 1949. There's been a change of leadership, of course, but in many obvious and many subtle ways, there have been changes of policy and changes of atmosphere. I was struck on my recent visit with several things. One, in a sense, there's a relaxation in China in the atmosphere, in ideological terms. And you sense this in personal contacts with people. They're less uptight than they were during the Cultural Revolution, immediate Cultural Revolution period. At the same time, there's a tightening up of discipline after sort of a confused political situation that's gone on for almost a decade in China. There's a shift in economic policy, which we can talk about if you'd like, in all kinds of fields, or at least, maybe shift is not the right word, because some of these trends were evident under Zhou Enlai in the post-Cultural Revolution period, but now the leftist opposition is gone, so there's a trend towards increasingly pragmatic economic policies, putting emphasis not on ideological and social values, but on increased production, greater efficiency, and so on. And there's at least a slight thaw intellectually and in the arts and so on, which is interesting, and we'll wait to see how far it goes.
Ken Lieberthal, when you were there in August, did you find some of these same signs of change?
Very much so. I had made my previous trip to China just 12 months before, and the change from August of 1976 to August of 1977 was dramatic.
Give me a for instance, Ken.
In talking with people at the Peking No. 150 Middle School about changes in educational policy that were then being debated, the head of the school was willing not only to discuss previous problems and current policy, but also the person's hopes for future policy. And that's a type of speculative discussion that a year ago would have been impossible in China. And we found that this change in tone, a willingness to come to grips with problems openly, a willingness to ask us our opinions and our experiences in the United States with the same kinds of issues, was just a dramatic change from what had occurred 12 months earlier.
Jim Reardon Anderson, you're about to go to China yourself. You've been reading a great deal about it. How does that jibe with what you've been...
It fits quite closely with my own understanding of what's gone on in China. During the last decade, most Western observers of China noted particularly the difficulties created by an atmosphere of political struggle, and greet with some alacrity or welcome the relaxation of a period of political struggle and a re-emphasis on pragmatic politics, economic growth, production in command. But I think we'll also want to look at the other side of the coin, and that is at the possibility that the lifting of the political tensions will lead to its own kind of problems. Chairman Mao, I think, saw the potential for bureaucratic abuses, the growth of a black market, bureaucratic corruption, and the like. And in a period of political relaxation and a perhaps opportunity for those in power to make a quick buck off of the system, I think we'll have an opportunity to judge whether the chairman's concerns about the future direction of China were well-founded.
Doak, when you talk about pragmatic in China, must mean something different in Chinese terms than in our own. What does it mean in economic and political terms in China?
Right, it means a great series of things, and here you have to get back to some understanding of the basic political conflict that's been going on in China for a long time between a group that put the highest priority on changes in social values in China, in revolution, in ideological values.
Is this Mao?
Well, Mao certainly was the symbol for these people, but some of the people who we've labeled radicals pushed it probably farther than Mao would have
himself. The Gang of Four?
The Gang of Four, so-called. And on the other side, people who are more concerned about making things work, if you will, economic growth being a very high priority here.
At this point, Doak Barnett said that in the past, there seemed to be greater concern in some factories for a version of participatory democracy than for production. And the radicals had been opposed in principle to what they called materialistic incentives. That is, using bonuses or raising pay to provide an incentive for greater production. Doak Barnett continues.
At the present time, there's the first major wage increase in China for many, many years.
Where does the money come from for that wage increase? What do they take it out of?
Well, it comes out of the state budget. Actually, if you add it all up, it's not going to be that much. It's about 50% of the industrial workers, which may be, 20 million people, and it's a 10 to 15% wage increase for these people. It's manageable within their budget, although what it may do is initiate a process in which the pressures for increased income and so on get greater and greater over time, which will create new problems. In education, as Ken said, there have been some very great changes there. The radicals implied that educational policy ought to be directed above all towards egalitarian values. You should pick people from the countryside, you should pick people from worker and peasant background, you shouldn't insist people have a gap between high school and university and so on. Not have examinations for entrance, not put much stress on examinations during university work and so on. This is all changing. The stress now is on examinations, on standards, and so on. Well, some of the dangers that Jim mentioned are clearly inherent in this, but I think the present leadership have weighed those dangers, rightly or wrongly, against the costs of pursuing the previous kinds of policies, and they're moving in these new directions.
Jim, do you think it can be said that these changes are a matter of settled policy within the Peking leadership and that the debate upon them is in the past?
Yeah, I think on a number of basic domestic policies, such as wage policy and education policy, we see a pretty clear direction which fits with the attack on the Gang of Four. There is a real determination here to carry out the so-called four modernizations, and that means material incentives, and it means greater stress on expertise and education and the like. But I have the sense that this is taking them into some dangers that perhaps they are not unaware of but unable to deal with at this time because of the mood that Doak talks about, the post-Maoist mood of relaxation.
Dangers like?
Particularly in the area of wages. The problem has been that there hasn't been, and there's not likely to be in the near future, enough consumer goods to soak up these increased wages. And so the question becomes, how do you get the ration cards to buy that bicycle, that sewing machine, those extra consumer goods that you'd like to buy with your new increased wages? If they are unable to come up with a lot more consumer goods a lot faster than they have been, it seems to me that this opens the door to illegal or extra-legal means of acquiring these goods, and that's a problem that the chairman was concerned about.
Ken, do you agree that these policy disputes on these major questions of how to organize the society are behind us?
Well, I think the basic consensus on what the society should look like is there. but many very tough decisions remain to be made. If you read the Chinese media over the past year since Mao's death and the overthrow of the radicals, what you find are strong commitments to major policies in a very wide range of areas, almost all of which will drain the budget. Well, the budget, in fact, has been overdrawn each of the last 4 years before Mao died, and one of their other commitments is to keep a balanced budget. So it's unclear where all this money will come from, or to put it differently, it seems to me that they have not yet made the hard allocational decisions that will have to be made, I would think, during the course of this year. They've spent a year pulling the economy together and getting a sense of it.
Well, now, I read the other day that the Chinese are sending a delegation of oil experts to this country, and there's been much talk of Chinese oil drilling beyond the needs of their own economy. Is that a particular area in which they might proceed in order to get foreign exchange to cover?
I think that's definitely one of several areas where they want to proceed to get foreign exchange oil. They also want to export coal, may export a higher quantity of some other minerals, and want to push textile exports. But there are problems with all of this. When you have a rapidly growing domestic economy, it soaks up more oil. If you want to increase oil output, say in the Gulf of Jurli, where they have a substantial underwater oil reserve, they have to import foreign technology for that, which is very expensive. It's something that has a long lead time, so it will be several years, probably 5 years, before they can begin to get oil to export from that. So this all presents a squeeze in the near future, and a squeeze that will be difficult to resolve and may produce political conflict.
How do they get out of that squeeze, Doak?
Well, let me elaborate, though, first on what he's saying, because I think it's very important. For at least the last 10 years, and maybe you can say the last 20 years since the late 1950s, the political debates, the policy debates, the struggles in China have been of a particular kind, highly charged ideologically, with people who had quite different approaches and objectives or values or priorities anyway. I think what has happened in the last year is, in many respects, in my judgment, that's basically been solved. But that doesn't mean there's a smooth road ahead for China. I think there's a fairly wide consensus on a general direction of policy, but as the comments made already indicate, expectations have been raised in all kinds of fields. And there's a new political ballgame in China, and it's going to be a tough one. There's going to be one arguing over allocation of resources. They've raised expectations about some rise in living standards. They've raised expectations for more rapid agricultural growth. They've raised expectations for accelerated industrialization. They've raised expectations about military modernization. Now, the fact is that China does not have the resources to do all these things rapidly. So that the politics of China, I think, in the next few years are going to involve intense debate and intense policy issues over what you give priority among these, and this is going to be very tough.
Would it be fair to say that one of the basic allocation of resources questions has got to be guns or butter, and that the size of the military budget is one of the shrinkable items, possibly, to provide the resources in order to give more to the civilian sector? Ken Lieberthal?
Both shrinkable and expandable. The military played a major role in the overthrow of the Gang of Four. The military has a very powerful political position in Chinese society now. And there has clearly been a debate, reflected in the public media from China, over the size of the military budget and the composition of that budget, over such questions as whether China should import military-related technology and perhaps even weapon systems from abroad, over what percentage of the military budget should go into development of heavy industry within China so that China can support its own military, advanced military establishment in future years, and how much you can allocate to guns as a whole as versus butter. I think it's a very, very difficult issue in China now. It's an issue that will be resolved in part as a function of military requirements and in part as a function of political debate where the military plays a very important role in the running of the society.
Jim Reardon Anderson, do you think those priorities are going to be so tightly fought out in the coming years that we'll see yet another upset in the political leadership over this allocation of resources question?
Well, I think that part of the problem of this shift toward pragmatism is a decline of some of the ideological themes that provided the real cement for Chinese society over the last three decades. When you can no longer hold out the ideals of egalitarianism and the like, and you begin to appeal very often to the better off segments of society, the children of better paid urban classes having a better chance to make it to the university and the like, you sacrifice something of the ideals that provided the real glue for this society. And I think that's one of the costs of a shift toward pragmatism, and I think it's likely to create its own tensions within Chinese society in the next decade.
That's something which I think Jim and I probably have a disagreement about. I see the point, but I would argue that the kind of ideological cement that he's talking about is not required to cement China. There are other very important things that can be a motivation for Chinese society and for Chinese people. Nationalism is one of them. I think nationalism has been a basic cement in China for many years, and I think it will continue to be very important. I think certain national developmental goals can be a cement. I would also argue that ideology was not just a cement over the last decade or two, but that it was also a highly divisive influence in China, and a reduction of the polarization ideologically could lead to a greater consensus in some respects. Now, I would not argue there's going to be a very different situation from the last two decades, but I do not think I would agree that the reduction of emphasis on the ideological conflicts and ideological values of the past two decades necessarily in and of itself creates a whole set of new problems.
Ken, when one speaks of the question of whether to buy certain military equipment overseas and whether to spend more or less on the budget or build this piece of military machinery or that piece, one is inevitably drawn into the question of what the Chinese think their military requirements are. That is to say, in their eyes, what is their military situation? Does the Soviet Union remain such a great overwhelming threat to them?
I think that all current leaders in China believe that the Soviet Union is an overwhelming military threat to them for the remainder of this century, that they therefore place military preparedness high on their agenda. I think that one of the major conflicts in foreign policy between the current leadership, the frequently called moderates, and the radicals whom they overthrew, was in disagreement over whether the threat from the Soviet Union was really inherently military in nature or whether it was the threat of an alternative political system and a political subversion of the revolution and so forth. With the overthrow of the radicals, I think the military conception of that threat has clearly won out. There can still remain, though, very significant disputes over how you deter that threat. Do you, for instance, stress the relationship with the United States, hoping that the United States will provide a major part of that deterrent? Do you import some modern weapons systems now, which may delay your own ability to produce your own weapons for deterrence, but will give you a quick fix and perhaps make the Soviets think yet another time before being provocative along the Sino-Soviet border? Do you go more for nuclear deterrence and longer-range missiles that are capable of hitting Moscow, for instance, or do you build up your conventional weapons capability? So the agreement on the military dimension of the threat and on the importance of that dimension of the threat does not necessarily produce agreement on a wide range of other very important questions.
But would it be fair to say that these are unresolved questions at this point in Peking? Because we've been talking about how there seems to be a fair amount of consensus on domestic policy. Should we say that in consideration of this military foreign problem, that the debate is still open?
Yes, I think many of these issues are still being debated. If you look at their foreign policy posture, on the surface it looks as if they've just reasserted the Maoist position in terms of global politics, and they stress the Soviet threat and the need to mobilize whatever support is possible against it. On the other hand, I am convinced in my bones that even that broad strategic conception is one either now is or will be a subject of debate. And then all these concrete issues that Ken was mentioning, it seems to me, are clearly subjects of debate. And I think on the military side of things, China faces a really tremendous dilemma. She sees one active threat and one potential threat, the United States. She sees that China is terribly inferior in military terms to both of these. And yet the costs and the difficult choices of trying to improve her defensive capabilities militarily are just horrendous. And I think there are some in China, and this again I think there's evidence of in the press and so on, there are some in China who say what we need first to do is spend a period maybe to the end of the century building up our basic economic strength on the basis of which we can then have a stronger defense establishment. And those who say we're in a pretty bad state right now, particularly I would think in conventional term, and that we've got to start putting some investment into this. And some investment is obviously going. I mean, their purchase of the Rolls-Royce Spey engine, for example.
Which they use for?
Which is, they are now trying to get into production and will produce a new plane, which will be only 10 years behind Soviet and American planes instead of 20 years behind Soviet American planes. But how much are they going to invest in that? It's going to be, they have the third largest air force in the world with 5,000 airplanes now, almost all of which are really obsolete. How many are they going to build of these new ones? These are terribly difficult decisions.
Do you think that there is in China a group of people who say, look, we've just come through the worst, most dangerous period, the time when the Russians, had they wanted to, might have been tempted to try to take out our nuclear facilities to provoke a preemptive strike or something like that by the Russians. And now we can relax a little bit and concentrate on economic development and improving the living standards of the people. Does anyone argue that in China, Jim?
Well, it seems to me that one can argue very persuasively for some relaxation of tensions on the Sino-Soviet border. Clearly, the level of tensions which have prevailed now for the last almost two decades were very much of China's making. China contributed a great deal to that, and it creates all kinds of problems that a new regime seeking to increase production and distribution would want to relax. But nevertheless, it seems to me that China's basic strategic problems are rooted in the nature of the Asian continent. That a long border facing a people of a different race and a different civilization creates its natural tensions on both sides. And for that reason, it seems to me that China's strategic orientation is going to continue to be that which it has been for the last 3,000 years.
Well, now, recently there was announced that some river navigation talks had taken place between Russia and China with some positive outcome. Is that some sign of relaxation there that's of any meaning?
Yeah, I think the navigation agreement, there are also some signs people are beginning to attend each other's diplomatic receptions and the like. I think that sort of thing can help to cool the atmosphere. But it doesn't seem to me that in any way can overcome the fundamental strategic problem, which is this continental border.
Ken?
There are three small points I would add to that. One, I think the debate among current leaders over diplomatic strategy to pursue vis-a-vis the Soviet Union is one that, on the one side, you find the argument that we should occasionally sign a border river navigation agreement or send our foreign minister to the Soviet embassy for the reception in honor of the Soviet Revolution and that kind of thing, to suggest that there may be a diplomatic solution to our problems over the long run and thereby to undercut the hawks in Moscow. People on the other side argue that the Soviets regard such moves as a sign of weakness, a sign that the new leadership will not have the strength of the previous leadership in China, and the Soviets take advantage only of those who are weak, and therefore we should have not only a hard line, but even an abusive, contemptible line toward the Soviet Union. And I think you see both of these now in the Chinese stance vis-a-vis the Soviets. I would add on the Soviet side, for the period since 1969 until Mao's death, the Soviets argued strongly that it was in the Soviet interest for the moderates to win in China, that the radicals were wild men. They just didn't understand the costs of war and so forth, and so the moderates were reasonable people. I think what the Soviets are now rapidly learning, if they didn't have a glimmer of it before, is that it's not in their interest for the moderates to win, because the moderates are going to stand a better chance of producing a strong, united China, a China with greater military strength and with better connections in the international arena. The radicals, for all of their fervor, nevertheless, were more likely to keep China divided and weak, and therefore pose less of a threat to Soviet interests. And the last brief point is that I find it virtually inconceivable that there could be major military conflict between China and the Soviet Union that was planned by either side. But I would note that both countries are now in the midst of secessions, and during secessions, small incidents can be blown up for internal political purposes and can acquire a dynamic all of their own. So my own feeling is that if there were to be military conflict between China and the Soviet Union, far more likely than not, it would be the result of an unintended escalation of events.
Doak?
Yeah, I think in looking at Sino-Soviet relations, it's important not only to try to analyze and understand the precise immediate situation, but also to sort of think about what the possibilities are over a period of years ahead. If you look at the present situation, I would say that there has so far been no significant sign of any reassessment by the Chinese of their basic posture, which is one of confrontation politically with the Soviet Union, as I said earlier. On the other hand, you have these small signs, which some people would say are cosmetic, of the navigation treaty and these other things, of a cooling of the tensions and a greater civility in state-to-state relations. I think, though, as I would look ahead, I would myself say the following. I see no possibility in the foreseeable future for a far-reaching rapprochement between China and the Soviet Union, a restoration of a close alliance, a cooperative, close cooperative type of relation. I see, however, myself, a very good possibility that the Chinese will go beyond cosmetic improvement of and civility in state-to-state relations, and at some point think about their global strategy and perhaps modify it and move towards what I would label limited détente with the Soviet Union, and towards a more flexible and, if you will, maneuverable sort of policy in dealing with both the Soviet Union and the United States. If they were to move in this direction, which I think is possible over the next several years, I think the motivation would be to try to improve China's security, but by a new overall strategy, and to try to increase China's flexibility in dealing with both of the superpowers. Right, well, Japan is very important to China, obviously. It's extremely important to us. Let's go back to the beginning in looking in this part of the world. I think you now have to look at this part of the world as one in which there are four major powers, all playing extremely important roles, interacting in a most complex way, and that there is a kind of equilibrium, a peculiar equilibrium with many kinds of asymmetries in it, but a kind of equilibrium among them. Now, Japan's role in this is obviously very important. Even though it is a very weak power militarily, it's an extremely strong power economically. China views Japan, I think, in part as important to it for economic reasons. It is its largest trading partner. It is its major source of technology and capital goods at the present time for the modernization program that China wants to push. But even more important, I would say that China views it as actually and potentially of importance from a security and strategic point of view. And China is very concerned about what Japan's general alignment will be. As you probably know, since the Chinese opening the United States, it has strongly endorsed a close U.S.-Japanese relationship because it has feared that Japan might be tempted to tilt somewhat more to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union would obviously like to have it detach more from the United States and tilt more towards the Soviet Union, so that there is a competition going on between China and the Soviet Union to try to influence Japan's general position, general alignment in Asia, just as there's Sino-Soviet competition going on in every area of Asia, Northeast Asia, Korea, Southeast Asia, and so on.
Ken, when you were in East Asia, Ken, when you were in East Asia, did you find any signs that Japan, in fact, was tipping more towards the Soviet Union?
No.
Where is the tip in Tokyo?
I think that Tokyo is bending over backwards to maintain a policy of equidistance.
It's not tipping, it's bending.
It's balancing and bending.
All right.
They, I think, fear the Soviet Union, fear it far more than they fear China. At the same time, they are reluctant to get involved in, say, the development of Siberian resources, which the Soviet Union has invited them to participate in, because they don't want to become alienated from China. So I think their preferred position is to maintain a strong U.S. role in the area, particularly in security concerns, and to stand back from both the Soviet Union and China and try to maximize the benefits of the relationship with each and minimize concrete involvement with each.
Well, now, at this point in our discussion, when here we are with Doak Barnett of Brookings and Kenneth Lieberthal of Swarthmore and James Reardon Anderson of Johns Hopkins, we have to get over to that other little part of China that we haven't talked about at all in this discussion, which is, of course, Taiwan, the 16 million people on that island there with a future that's certainly very much up in the air. How do you start talking, Jim, about where Taiwan fits into this Chinese puzzle?
I start talking about Taiwan by putting it at the end, because it seems to me that the question of Taiwan fits in basically to the issue of normalization of U.S.-China relations, and that the whole question of normalization, because it has the it is in an area of conflict now and is in the press very much, we tend to give it too much weight. In fact, it seems to me that U.S.-China relations are today as good as they have been at any time in the 20th century, that those relations are good because they're based on an ability and willingness of each side to fulfill the major strategic interests of the other side. We are basically playing the role the Chinese would like us to play in maintaining our position in East Asia and preventing Soviet expansion. They are playing the role we would like them to play in basically cooling it in the region, while the process of U.S. retrenchment continues. So I see U.S.-China relations really based on that parallel cooperation on strategic issues, and it seems to me that both parties are happy to set Taiwan aside in the immediate and near future.
Well, now I want to solicit the views of both of our recent Peking visitors on your suggestion that China is essentially satisfied with our current China policy and doesn't mind that we continue to alienate Taiwan from the mainland. Ken?
On a verbal level, that's not true, which is to say the Chinese say they are not satisfied and want us to move ahead on the Taiwan issue. But they have set up three conditions for movement on the Taiwan issue and have elaborated on those conditions in a way that they know is unacceptable to the Carter administration and I would suspect to any administration. And so the question really
those three conditions are
that we break relations with Taiwan and establish full diplomatic relations with Peking, that we withdraw all of our military forces from Taiwan, and that we break our security treaty with Taiwan. The first two conditions pose no problem at all. It's the third condition which presents some difficulties.
The breaking of the treaty.
Once we've broken the treaty, the question is, what type of relationship do we have with Taiwan? Can we, for instance, continue to sell arms to Taiwan, even while not maintaining a formal security commitment with the island? If Peking is adamant in refusing to allow us to maintain Taiwan's military capabilities at a level that would maintain an effective deterrent against an attack from the mainland, then it seems to me that it's going to be very difficult for us to reach a full normalization agreement. Now, it's possible that Peking will maintain a rigid attitude on that because during a period of succession in China, Taiwan is in some ways too hot an issue to handle, that it would be too difficult for anyone in the current leadership to propose the type of compromise that they know will be necessary in order to have any hope of fulfilling the process of normalization with the United States.
Nobody wants to be soft on Taiwan.
That's right. And so it's unclear whether they are really satisfied with the U.S. or really dissatisfied. Their rhetoric is hard-lying on it. At the same time, they have shown a willingness to maintain and in some ways to expand, I would argue, over the past year, our relationship in other areas, in cultural exchanges. I think the level of trade will be going up somewhat. In a range of areas, our relationship is firming up. But the Taiwan issue will remain nettlesome, and it may simply be too difficult an issue for the current leadership to handle now.
I think both Jim and Ken take a too optimistic view of the dilemmas which the Taiwan problem present internationally, and particularly for the United States. I would argue that the opening, which started in the late 60s and was consummated in 72 between China and the United States, was motivated above all by broad strategic factors on both sides, and that the strongest Chinese motive was the desire to get a counterweight on the part of the U.S. to restrain the Soviet Union, but that a secondary and important motive was an attempt to resolve the Taiwan issue. I think what many Americans underestimate is the symbolic importance of Taiwan to China. It is regarded as Chinese territory. As long as the United States is as involved as it is now, as long as the United States treats the government on Taiwan as the government of China, which we are, I think this is a galling thing to the Chinese. And I think it remains a basic objective of theirs to change this. Now, the degree to which they press us and express dissatisfaction varies. You could trace it up and down over the last 6 months. A few months ago, they were pressing us. Right now, I'd say they're not. A few months from now, they may again. But I think that our relationship with China is tentative at the present time, limited, and I would even argue fragile. It depends fundamentally on Chinese decisions about their broad strategic objectives. So that I personally feel, and I feel quite strongly, that if we cannot move ahead on full normalization, that over time the dangers will increase that our relationship with Peking could go backward rather than forward. Incidentally, their posture, which I don't think they're going to fundamentally change, is that there is not going to be very much development of other relationships, including trade, until normalization occurs. So I don't think that our relationship is going to go forward, and I would be fearful of it going backward. Now, in many respects, I would argue that facing this as a policy problem, domestic American politics is what worries me almost more than anything else. It seems to me that 2 years ago, the American public was prepared for a shift from official to non-official relations with Taiwan, which is what I think has to happen, as has happened in the case of Japan. I think it is less prepared for that now. I think 2 years from now, the swing of public opinion may freeze us into an immobile position as far as our ability to make the compromises necessary for normalization. Now, if that is the case, I would be very pessimistic in the sense that I think over time the Chinese would react to this. This would encourage them to reassess their strategic policy, and I think that their policy toward both the Soviet Union and the United States could undergo not sudden, dramatic, but gradual and important changes that would be adverse to our interests in Asia.
Well, I think Doak puts his finger on the real key issue when he talks about American domestic opinion. And I would add to that that the Chinese are very much in the same situation. Both administrations, both the Peking and Washington administrations, it seems to me, face serious political opposition within their countries to any sort of compromise which could be thought to be a sellout of Taiwan, each from perspective of the respective sides. It would seem to me that being the case, For the Carter administration to seek to push through normalization at the present time and to accept something along the lines of the very tough terms that Peking is demanding would be not likely to succeed. It is not likely that Carter could get the support he needs from Congress to carry out those steps, and it would be more likely in the present political atmosphere in this country to provoke what I think might be a very bitter and divisive debate on some fundamental questions about U.S. foreign policy and about the nature of American society. And here I see on the horizon questions about do we sell out our friends? How do we treat our friends? What is our attitude toward human rights and the like, which seems to me more likely to divide this country and to undermine what is by all odds, in my judgment, the best relationship we have had in East Asia for a very long time.
So you are suggesting that our fundamental foreign policy interest and the basic currents of our domestic scene right now are going in opposite directions.
I think President Carter has correctly put his finger on the critical issues of U.S. foreign policy, SALT, Southern Africa, the Middle East, the Panama Canal Treaty, and that insofar as he has political clout, political leverage with the Congress, he'd better put them on those issues.
Ken?
I'm somewhere in between, I think, actually. I think that Doak's mention earlier of the importance of nationalism in China is really pertinent to this question. We simply don't know what's going to happen with the Taiwan issue on the Chinese side. I took one view of it a few minutes ago, saying that it may be impossible for anyone to propose a compromise. The other question is whether the political situation in China will push the Chinese to become much more hard-line on this issue, and aggressively so, either verbally or perhaps by increased presence in the Taiwan Straits, or by increasing tension around Quemoy, just off the coast of China and occupied by the nationalists. So we could be moving into a situation in the future where the Taiwan issue could become central to the relationship and produce a deterioration in our bilateral relations. And that, indeed, is the major reason why I would argue that President Carter now should begin to seize hold of this issue, and once the Panama Canal Treaty is off of the agenda of Congress, put the normalization of relations on the agenda of Congress. Let me add one other note to that, which is that our relationship with China really has two major dimensions to it. One is the strictly bilateral level, and the other is a broader, what both sides call, parallelism in our interests. And I would doubt that even if our bilateral relationship should deteriorate badly, that the Chinese will then try to push us out of Japan, would pressure the Philippines to get us out of Subic Bay, and in other areas would try to undermine those parallel interests. So I think they would try to, if you will, contain the damage to the bilateral dimension of our relationship.
Well, Doak, in your book, China Policy, Old Problems and New Challenges, you suggest making a change in our policy on Taiwan and meeting the Peking conditions, but you also seem to have some lingering doubts about just how reliable Peking might be in its attitude towards Taiwan. You suggest, for instance, that the U.S. should make a unilateral security statement in favor of Taiwan security, and that the U.S. should be allowed to continue selling arms to Taiwan. Those statements suggest that you don't really have full confidence in Peking when Peking says that it's interested in peaceful means of liberation of Taiwan.
Well, I think any realist in international affairs looking at this situation can't exclude the possibility that over time Peking might consider at some time in the future military action against Taiwan. That's why I think it's important to have these what I call substitutes for a formal treaty. I would say, though, that Peking has no capability for amphibious attack on Taiwan now, and my impression from American military leaders is that they're not likely to have any for the next 5 to 10 years, so that in the immediate future, making statements of this kind and assuring that Taiwan has access to, I don't say necessarily we have to be the ones that sell them arms, but that they have access to arms. I think the political objectives of this are as important as the military, and that is assuring the people in Taiwan and elsewhere in Asia to help preserve a stable situation, that we are not, in fact, quote, withdrawing, unquote, or, quote, abandoning Taiwan, unquote. But I'd like to make another very general comment about the dilemmas that this situation poses for the United States. And I think they're very profound and very deep dilemmas, and they are very disturbing to me. Having watched U.S.-China relations closely for 30 years now, it seems to me, and you could say this about some other international relationships, that there are, the timing of things is extremely important, and that there are certain periods, what some people call windows, when a combination of circumstances makes certain actions possible. I would say that since 1972, there's been a window for a genuine normalization of relations between us and China, a consolidation of those relations that would lay the basis for a lasting relationship that could develop gradually over time. I think this window could close, and the trends both in Chinese policy and in U.S. opinion, congressional public opinion affecting policy, could freeze us into situations in which it's almost certain that we would begin to again have frictions over Taiwan in particular, and that our relationship could go backward. And therefore, I think time is very important. I'd make one more comment. I guess I would agree with Ken that I would not see in the immediate future a danger that China would suddenly become, or suddenly shift its policy to the extent of deliberately making problems in a major way for us all around its periphery. I could see, however, a change of situation in which the present Chinese policy towards Korea, towards Japan, towards Southeast Asia, which is really very benign and helpful from our point of view, could gradually change and create new problems in all of these areas. And this would depend on our bilateral relationship as well as on the broad triangular relationship or quadrangular relationship of the major powers.
Well, now, the other day, the People's Daily had one of those articles accusing the United States of appeasing the Soviet Union. This is perhaps a common theme. They like to invite our hawks to visit them. Jim Schlesinger, a year or so ago, for instance, earlier this year, they extended an invitation to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the president's national security advisor, who in our own spectrum of things is sometimes put a little more on the harder end of the spectrum. As long as they are berating us for appeasing the Soviet Union, does that not demonstrate a preoccupation with the Soviet and strategic aspect, which allows us to say, well, we can just let Taiwan float? The window is going to stay open for a longer period of time.
Well, as I've tried to indicate before, that is my view. It seems to me that the public rhetoric is rather extreme. The Chinese are constantly trying to get us to believe that war with the Soviet Union is imminent and the like, and I don't think we have to take that kind of advice. But I would pick up on what I think can really put the problem correctly, and that is there's an important distinction to be made here between bilateral and parallel interests. It seems to me that if the Carter administration has done anything so far that is significant in the way of affecting our relations with China, it was in the surprise announcement, and I say surprise because it surprised not only our friends and enemies abroad, but surprised our own administration, in the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Korea. It seems to me that the Chinese are much more interested in our basic strategic presence in Asia than they are in our failure or willingness to resolve the Taiwan issue. And by announcing a withdrawal in the way it was done, it was certainly unsettling to people in this country, and I think it was probably also unsettling to the Chinese. I think it would be much wiser for the Carter administration, if they want to maintain the current level of detente in U.S.-China relations, to moderate its pace of change of strategic deployments in East Asia, and that this is the real way to maintain the current level of U.S.-China detente.
Ken?
I'd like to pull together several different parts of this conversation because they're really relevant to this issue. We began this discussion saying that the Chinese leadership was basically united and were looking toward a program of rapid modernization. Then commented that there were some still tough choices to be made by that leadership, of an allocational nature, if you will, and then moved on to foreign policy and have tried to assess the importance of the Soviet threat to China as versus the Taiwan issue. I think the real danger vis-a-vis the Taiwan question and the real problem with Jim's perspective is the issue of whether or not Taiwan will be caught up in succession politics, whether or not still in China there is a struggle for power going on, a struggle that in part is policy-oriented over such nettlesome issues for China as how you assess the Cultural Revolution, where roughly half the current Politburo rose during the Cultural Revolution and the other half have been purged by the Cultural Revolution. And if that struggle is still going on, Taiwan is certainly the kind of issue that could be brought into it, could be used by one group to try to undercut another, to press them hard, to box them in. And so while I agree fully with Jim that in rational terms, in broad strategic assessment, that China is absolutely focused in all dimensions on the Soviet Union, their entire foreign policy is now structured fundamentally around containing a Soviet threat. Nevertheless, I don't think it's possible to, with confidence, rule out the possibility that Taiwan will become a central issue in Chinese politics, largely as a function of the politics of succession, of factional struggles within China.
But don't they, meanwhile, have to concentrate on their economic development? I note in the trade between the U.S. and China, for instance, the total of it in 1976 was about $0.33 billion. That happens to be the level of our trade with Honduras. It happens to be a tenth of the level of trade we had with Taiwan. This seems to be a remarkably nominal, negligible sum of trade for two great countries, if you will. Is that so hopelessly tied to the politics of the thing, Doak?
Well, let me comment very briefly on that, but then I'd like to go back to this basic Please. Issue we're talking about. For whatever it's worth, when I was in China, the group I was with had an interview with Vice Premier Deng Xiaoping, who in many respects I think is running domestic and foreign policy in China. And he said very explicitly that as long as there was no normalization, there would be no significant increase in U.S.-China trade, and China would buy things that it could get in Japan and Europe there, even if the price was somewhat higher. This is almost a direct quote. Now, I think that China is going to buy a little bit more from us of high technology things that are special in the United States she can't get elsewhere. But I think the lack of normalization, at least under existing policy, is going to keep our trade level very, very, very low. But let me go back to this fundamental issue that we're talking about. I would like to very much endorse what Ken just said, that we cannot exclude that Taiwan could go up on the agenda of objective and of policy issues in China. I think there's a very wide tendency of Americans now, including many good observers, to have a rating of Chinese objectives and to say that because concern with security in the Soviet Union is the central focus of Chinese policy, therefore, Taiwan is an unimportant part of Chinese policy. And I disagree with that. I agree with the first part, but not the second part. In other words, I think it's quite clearly at the present time that Chinese policy is focused on the Soviet threat, and that is the highest priority. But I think Taiwan remains a latent and very important issue in Chinese policy, which could go up on the agenda. I would argue that over a period of time, that there are going to be two variables that are both going to be crucial in shaping U.S.-China relations. And one of them is this broad strategic relationship, primarily the triangular, but also involving Japan. But the second is also going to be the Taiwan issue because of its symbolic importance. The Chinese believed that we, in the Shanghai communique in 1972, implicitly promised that we would change our relationship with Taiwan and normalize with Peking. And they're going to judge our intentions to a certain extent about whether we follow through on that. Now, a second point I'd like to make, and relevant to Jim's, I think if one could assume that 2 years from now or 3 years from now, the problem of moving ahead towards normalization would be easier, or even if one could assume it's not going to be more difficult than now, then I would be rather complacent. I would say, Yes, let's let it ride along at the present time and then face up to it later on. My own judgment is that, it, as I said, the window may be closing, that it's going to be getting harder, and it may become impossible. And over, if that does occur, and that's what worries me, then it seems to me the dynamic of relationships over time may well undergo change.
Well, now, the president has on his diplomatic political calendar in 1978 as the first order of business the Panama Canal. The SALT treaties will perhaps come along in the middle of the year with some good luck. Difficult to say what the Middle East is going to present for American political consideration, but it does look as though the year 1978 is already penciled in pretty thoroughly. And I think we would all agree there is some limit to the number of times a president can go to fight foreign policy battles, particularly when most of the negatives are the same people, and you've got to beat them down time and time and again, and it makes it difficult to construct alliances of convenience on one issue and then shift to another. Now, the Chinese, it's been since 72, it's been, let us say, 6 years, does look as though at least they've got to get into a seventh year on the thing, don't you think?
Well, this is precisely what worries me. I think if one makes a realistic assessment about the Carter administration's intentions on, I think it is correct to say that in early 1977, the Carter administration seriously hoped to move ahead on normalization in 77 or early 78. I think then when Panama came to the fore, it was clear to everyone that it would have to be after Panama. And the hope was that Panama would be through by early 78 and that then they could turn to the China issue. I think now the appearance is that SALT is likely to preempt the China issue after Panama, so that it is not a hopeful outlook. And if you take my view, I think this means that the long-run problem of dealing with China is being preempted by a whole series of immediate issues elsewhere.
Ken?
More than that, it's going to be very hard to present the Taiwan issue in a way that is politically attractive. We gain very little of a tangible way, in a tangible nature, by normalization. We clearly seem to give up something, and the argument for it is to prevent a greater unknown problem in the future, and that's a tough way to have to handle the issue.
Jim, the last word.
I don't think there is an open window at the present time. I don't think there is a basis by which the Carter administration can bring Peking and the Congress together.
Thank you, Doak Barnett, Kenneth Lieberthal, and James Reardon Anderson. When we put this title on our discussion, What's Next?, I'm glad we had a question mark at the end of it. Thank you.
And our thanks to our host, Stephen Rosenfeld of The Washington Post. Doak Barnett is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Professor Kenneth Lieberthal is with the Department of Political Science at Swarthmore College. And Dr. James Reardon Anderson is assistant professor of Asian Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. This edition of Options was produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Options is made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.